Hello and welcome to Volume 151 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the effect of inflation on forest management decisions. We'll talk about pond building. We'll find out about an agreement reached with Forever Wild relating to carbon credits. And we'll hear about a victory for Tennessee landowners in the Tennessee courts. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is attorney Robert Frommer with the Institute for Justice. Two of his clients, Terry Rainwater and Hunter Hollingsworth, successfully challenged a Tennessee statute that allowed game wardens to conduct warrantless trespass and surveillance on private property. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We spoke with your colleague, Josh Windham, in November of 2020 about this case, but remind us what the clients objected to and where things stand today.
Well, absolutely. My clients are just a couple of rural landowners. They own about 100-acre parcels around there, forested, and they would do things like farm and hunt and have friends over at the property. But what they found out was that the state of Tennessee was sending in wildlife resource officers without a warrant, without permission, to snoop on them and to see what if they're violating any hunting laws. In fact, it got so bad that at one point the state even installed cameras that could actually see one of my clients' houses, and that got them rattled. So we joined forces with them to challenge the statute that gave the Tennessee Wildlife Authority unbridled authority to come onto people's private land. And we said, if you want to come onto someone's land without their permission, you need a warrant.
All right. Where does the case stand today? Has there been any developments that we should be aware of?
Yes, there have been huge developments in the case. We brought this case, as you mentioned, a couple of years ago, and recently a special three-judge panel that was established by state law to hear constitutional challenges like this one issued an incredibly strong opinion, holding in no uncertain terms that the statute that gave those Tennessee wildlife officers unbridled access to my client's property violates the state's constitution against unreasonable searches and seizures. And it said that because under the Tennessee Constitution, just like the Alabama Constitution, it says that you're supposed to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures in your possessions. And when you go back and look at what that word means, it's pretty clear that it means not just your house, but all the land that you own and cultivate. And so that's a huge victory, not just for my clients, but for every landowner in Tennessee.
Okay. Language similar to the U.S. Constitution of the Fourth Amendment. Are there implications beyond the state of Tennessee in this ruling?
Absolutely. There's huge implications in this ruling, not just for the state of Tennessee, but for states like Alabama and other states throughout the nation. One thing that we're trying to do, the Institute for Justice is trying to do with its Fourth Amendment project, is to better secure people's rights to be secure in their persons and property. And this ruling was a very clear statement that under state constitutions, states don't have to live with wrong-headed decisions made by the United States Supreme Court a century ago. They can go their own way. And so, like I was saying, Tennessee has rejected this open fields doctrine. Mississippi has rejected this doctrine. Hopeful that Alabama should reject this doctrine. It has this exact same language in its constitution. And we anticipate taking this ruling to other states, like we have done in Pennsylvania just recently, to try to increase protections for property owners nationwide.
I understand, as expected, the case is appealed. Is that right? So there's still yet there's still some more news to in the future for us.
That's exactly right. The state obviously does not like the fact that the court told them they can't trespass with impunity anymore, and so they've taken the case up to the Tennessee Court of Appeals. But we're confident that no matter how far this case goes, we'll continue to prevail on behalf of our clients and all landowners throughout the state.
All right. Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that.
My pleasure.
In the news today is the Consumer Price Index figure for April. Inflation has risen to 8.3% for consumer goods. It's higher than expected. Our next guest, Richard Hall, can help us understand what this type of thing means to the timber economy. Welcome, Richard.
Great to be here.
How does higher inflation generally, how do the higher inflation rates impact forest management decisions throughout the Southeast?
Well, for forest landowners, higher inflation rates, especially what we're seeing right now, have a significant impact on the values of different types of inputs into silvicultural practices, notably fertilizer and herbicides. But there's also the overall cost of fuel, which is a significant component of the inflation we're seeing right now. And when you look at these higher costs of inputs, that increases your overall management costs based on these higher prices. And what that may mean for forest operations is that it may call for adjustments to forest management plans, and those adjustments may be in the form of deferred activities or other measures.
So it particularly affects, I guess, active managers who are trying to get everything that they possibly can and are using inputs to maximize their yield. What should forest owners be thinking about in these higher rates, especially related to what you've mentioned, tree planting and other management activities? How do you deal with a situation like this?
Well, first, you make a very good point about the different impacts these higher inflation rates may have on different types of owners and different management plans. Certainly, the ones that will be most impacted are those who are implementing the more intensive types of silvicultural practices that require more input, whereas other forest management practices that are less intense or may not be as effective. In terms of what forest landowners should be considering or doing, first and foremost, at this point, especially given the high rates we've seen over the last few months, forest landowners should consider consulting with their forestry consultant or advisors or their financial advisors to determine if their forest management plan warrants adjustments based on these higher input costs and relative to the long-term cash flow projections and target returns. Inflation now is to a point where it will move the needle, so to speak, on investment returns based on how landowners or managers incorporate these different inputs. Another point to consider, possibly, forest landowners may want to consider broadening the spectrum of options for forest management, especially as relates to the more intensive forest management. Private forest landowners may now actually want to consider different types of silvicultural regimes that they may not have considered before, notably natural reforestation practices such as shelter wood rotations or seed tree rotations that have lower input costs. Certainly that will affect the long-term implications for the management plan, but if near-term cash flow considerations are a priority, then consider a broader spectrum of silvicultural practices.
Okay. Well, that's good advice, Richard. Thanks for helping us understand that. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Building a pond on your property is a little more complicated than you think, but we have Norman Latona himself with Southeastern Pond Management to give us some tips. Hello, Norman.
Hello. Great to be here.
Norton, tell us what steps are normally associated with building a new pond.
Yeah, sure. So it's really just a pretty simple formula that we follow. We look at initially we look at a topo map. We look at the topo and see if we have the topography and the watershed that will allow a pond the feasibility. In other words, and then we'll follow that up frequently with an on-site assessment where we can actually put our boots on the ground and verify that what we're seeing on the map is in fact what exists, what's present, and we'll include in that an on-site survey where we'll actually survey the property, shoot water lines, and determine watershed area, and then from that information we'll come back and do a design. So we'll actually design the dam, the spillways, the shoreline contour, get into things like habitat placement, boat ramps, and boathouses, and basically establish waterline. And then from there we can go straight into the construction phase and the actual building, the dirt moving, and then of course stocking and management, which is where we come in. We get involved obviously heavily in the stocking of the fish and all the management inputs that follow.
Is there an ideal size and depth for a new pond in your view?
You know, it really, we talk about size in terms of fitting into a budget. The biggest factor there is that larger ponds are typically more costly to take care of than smaller ponds. I wouldn't say there's an ideal size, but there's definitely a correlation between cost and size. In other words, most of the management inputs that are important are based on acreage. So it takes more, it's more costly to manage a 100-acre impoundment than a 10-acre impoundment. You know, one thing we get questioned a lot about is depth. Again, depth is really overrated in terms of fish production. It's not that big of a factor. Depth has much more to do with storage capacity. So in cases where folks want to irrigate or have a need to have ample storage capacity, sure, water depth helps, but in terms of fish production, it's really not that big a factor.
Okay. What about the regulatory end of things? Are there regulations associated with this, and is anything changing right now?
Yeah, there really are. You know, presently, well, certainly the trend over the past 30 or so years has been toward an increase in the size and scope of regulations related to the construction of new watershed impoundments. Presently, we seem to be enjoying a bit of a relaxed regulatory climate, and as a result, we would encourage landowners to pursue goals related to new pond construction. The time to build a new pond is now. We always tell folks we sort of know what we're dealing with now. We may not be happy about the hoops that we're asked to jump through, but at least we know we can build these things. Who knows what the future holds? As I said, certainly the trend has been toward an increase, limiting our ability to do things. I'll say this, and we encourage a lot of folks, presently the regulations for pond construction, the permitting process, does not include existing impoundments. And so what we end up doing a lot of times is renovating, salvaging, rebuilding old lakes. In some cases even have been abandoned for years. Maybe the dam even blew out. But once these things have been established, they're sort of grandfathered in. So if you have a site that had a pond in the past, you can completely avoid those regulatory issues and requirements.
Okay. All right. So good tips. Norman, thank you for joining us. The Forever Wild program uses state oil and gas money to purchase private land and protect and conserve it. Once this happens, this land gets special treatment. It is removed from the tax rolls and is no longer supporting the counties where it is located in the same way that all privately owned land does. So what happens if Forever Wild protects and conserves the land by selling carbon credits? Does this money go to the counties where the land is located? Representative Ben Robbins, who represents parts of Coosa, Talladega, and Clay County, was concerned about this, and he's with us. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Well, thank you for having me.
You introduced a bill that was not passed yet, but you were able to work out a deal with Forever Wild. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, like you mentioned, Forever Wild, when it purchases land, it removes it from the, you know, it takes it off the ad valorem tax rolls. But any monies generated from Forever Wild land, whether it was selling a carbon credit or it's harvesting timber, all of that money goes to the state general fund. So any money that's generated off Forever Wild land goes to the state general fund. And so what I saw is, you know, representing Coosa County, which is, a relatively poor county, since 2008, when Forever Wild first started acquiring land in Coosa County, we had lost a total of $610,000 in property tax. Roughly 1% of the Coosa County ad valorem tax was off the tax rolls. And so I tried to think of an end around and say, well, if you sell carbon credits in the county in which you sell them, why not have that go back to the general fund as an offset? Well, you know, that was going to take a constitutional amendment, a vote by the people, and because Forever Wild is a constitutional amendment, it passed the House, was in the Senate, and a deal was worked out with Forever Wild. Well, Forever Wild will start paying a current use, and they will start paying current use tax to Coosa County, but also to every county in the state. They agreed to $1.60 per acre for every county where they hold land. For every acre. So that will be a benefit to, it will be a great benefit to some of our rural counties, such as Coosa County, that's just revenue that's been lost that now will be, that they will have that money back and be able to use it for just general services and for the school systems in the counties.
Okay, so this not only affects the counties that you represent, Coosa, Talladega, and Clay, but does this also affect other counties as well?
It will affect the entire state. So whether it's Cherokee County or Mobile County, any county now where Forever Wild, the trust owns land, they will now pay current use tax, and they agreed just to a set $1.60 per acre current use for the whole state, for every county, and they will pay that to every county. So the number of acres that they own, it will be per acres times $1.60. So, Coosa County has the largest per percentage wise of Forever Wild land, but, Mobile has a large ownership in Mobile County, and there's a large ownership in Cherokee County. So this will be a benefit to all counties, but definitely our rural counties that are always struggling to find revenue sources.
Mm-hmm. What do you know, or what is your view, I guess, about carbon credits in general and the effect that it has on public policy?
I mean, I think that, part of the reason I went down this road is that I saw that Alaska was actively with what, the first guest discussed about inflation, talking about the rising oil costs. And one of the things is that the Democrat agenda is reducing the oil supply. We're not drilling in Alaska. So Alaska is looking at ways to offset their losses from the oil revenues. And one of the things they were pursuing were carbon credits. So state-owned forests selling carbon credits. Mm-hmm. And I saw that the state of Michigan has sold them. So I think that it's going to be a wave in the future that states are going to see that they are sitting on a green asset. And they're going to say, well, this is a way to raise revenue without raising taxes. So I think it's going to be a policy that states will be pursuing in the next, 5-10 years.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ben. We appreciate that. That's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Robert Frommer, Richard Hall, Norman Latona, and Representative Ben Owens. The framers of the Bill of Rights included the assurance that the people have a right to be secure in their property from unreasonable searches and seizures. And even if a search warrant is issued, it must be with probable cause, under oath, and with particularity to the properties to be searched. So why can't a state legislature authorize its game wardens to go onto private property without a warrant and without the owner's permission? The temptation to do this is often joined with a more acceptable goal to stop crime, especially the manufacture and distribution of illegal drugs. But how do you balance the one thing, stopping illegal drugs, against the other thing, which is being secure in your property? As it turns out, forest owners and farmers are pushing back against this erosion of their Fourth Amendment rights and helping to define this balance in the courts. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.